On this episode of The Syndicate, we've got a lively roundtable of returning cinephiles, Dave and Blake of First Prize Films. We're diving headfirst into the whirlpool of complexities surrounding Yorgos Lanthimos' latest cinematic masterpiece, starring none other than Emma Stone, Mark Ruffalo, and Willem Dafoe. Poor Things has sparked diverse reactions, from walkouts in packed theaters to discussions on its potential Oscar worthiness, and even stirred debates on its murky waters that border fantastical elements and uncomfortable topics. Today we'll navigate through its storyline and characters, from Belle's relationship with Duncan and Max to her unconventional life choices. We'll also discuss the film's visual storytelling and its evolution from black and white simplicity to the full spectrum of a life lived chaotically. However, our discussion moves beyond the silver screen as we traverse the portrayal of women in film, societal expectations, and our personal frustrations with the Academy's biases. So join us and give a warm welcome to Dave and Blake as we tackle the dreamy, dark, and downright daring world of Poor Things. All that and more right here on The Syndicate.
Welcome to The Syndicate, a film and TV podcast. Be a part of the conversation as industry insiders, genre lovers, and cinephiles dare to peek beyond the curtains of imagination and dive into the art of cinema. Join us as we want you to spend less time scrolling and more time watching. Now here's your host, Armand Haddad.
Dave, Blake.
Hey. Armand, my friend.
Oh my God, thank you so much for coming back. I think it's been almost a year. Last time you guys were on, we watched, oh, what the hell did we watch?
American Psycho.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, because yeah,
I changed your mind, remember?
Yeah, I remember.
I don't remember anything.
Hey, I won, so of course I'm going to remember.
Everything's a competition to Dave. Film is a competition, and it doesn't matter. He's right, and he wins.
Thank you for finally realizing.
Do my part.
Well, Dave, you definitely won that conversation. Not saying that there's a competition right now with the film that we all watched, you know, for this podcast, which is Poor Things by Yorgos Lanthimos, starring Emma Stone and Mark Ruffalo and, of course, Willem Dafoe. But before we, like, dive into what this film is saying, the messages, themes, and all that good stuff, I want to talk about our first impressions leaving the theater, if we saw this movie in theaters. I don't know about you guys.
Yes.
But I guess I'll start with Blake. Blake, what were your first impressions like coming out of this movie?
I guess to set up, I'm a big Yorgos Lanthimos fan.
That's true.
So very hyped to see this. And I left with, it's a feeling unlike many others, but I was very happy. Like, I felt like happy. I felt... I don't know.
Energized.
Energetic. I wouldn't say this is like a feel-good film necessarily, but I left with like a feeling of, I don't want to say hope necessarily, but like, I don't know, a little bit of empowerment, a little bit of being seen in my 30s and still being unsure of the world. I love this movie. I left just thinking about it constantly. It didn't leave my head for a number of days. Nay, weeks.
Yeah, like I definitely empathize with you because like there was a pep in my step when I left this movie.
Yeah.
And it wasn't just because of Emma Stone's amazing performance for multiple different reasons.
Yes.
But like the message behind it, I was like, oh my God, like not only is Yorgos Lanthimos like an amazing director, you know.
Oh, yeah.
Like almost every single one of his movies are like so freaking weird, but they're also
so weird.
Executed so well. And like this movie, I'm like, holy crap. Not only did I watch a movie, I watched art. On
yes.
Absolutely. I was introduced to Yorgos Lanthimos by Blake, of course, because I don't watch movies. And
I'm so sorry.
I don't watch real movies anyway. I've seen all the Fast and Furious, though, so
that's my boy.
Nice. Well, anyway. This film is also about family. Wink.
It's true. And Corona. Similar, don't forget the Corona.
Similarly, yes. You know, thematically similar. Just yes. saying.
Yes. So I was introduced through a double feature, I believe, with The Lobster and The Favorite, and I decided that I liked the guy and his stuff. So when this movie came out and me being a mega fan of Emma Stone, I was like, yeah, we're going to watch this movie. I knew going in, you know, what kind of director Yorgos is, because they did not market it to be as weird as it really was. And I loved every second of this movie, both times I saw it in theaters.
Yes, I think we all yearned for original, like, stories being told on the silver screen instead of, you know, the Avengers 7 or Fast and the Furious. Dom Toretto goes to Mars, like,
I'd
watch it.
Ace favorite in entry, actually. But no, you're right. There's in the past couple of years, I think, you know, specifically with Everything Everywhere All at Once.
Oh yeah,
and a lot of things that not only were critically acclaimed, but the audiences loved and made money. And it's like the trifecta. And this is also another film that has made money. And well, okay, I guess I don't know the budget, so I can't say that. But it has done well at the box office. And yeah, I think people are ready for unique stories and unique art forms. And we're getting that.
Oh, yeah. I think a testament to it being so financially well in the box office is because, you know, we all go to the movies. I like going to the movies, you know, in person, just giant screen, like a time with no distractions or electronics and just in tune with the movie, whatever story it's being told to me. And most of the time I'm one of five people in the movie theater. And when I saw Poor Things, it was packed. I was like,
same.
This has been a hot minute since I've been in a packed movie theater.
Dude, so Dave and I did get to see this together, which we don't often do. And, you know, we showed up. You know, I bought my tickets a handful of days earlier. There's only a couple seats taken. But we walk into this theater late, not late to the movie starting, but late, you know, the previews had started. And I walk in and I look up and I was like, holy shit, there's a ton of people in here. And, you know, we live in L.A., it's a film city, but like you said, when we saw Everything Everywhere All at Once, there's like 10 other people in the theater. But this past year, and actually later in the year last year, going to see weirder kind of movies or more niche things, I was in packed theaters, man, and that made me really happy. I hate people. I don't like seeing movies with like a lot of people because everybody's crunching and talking and it's annoying, but this was definitely an experience, and the audience was losing it.
Yes, most of the audience was losing it. The person next to me got up and walked out halfway through.
We saw a few walkouts.
Are you serious?
Because like, I mean, obviously you remember like the previews made it seem like this nice little whimsical like coming of age story or whatever the hell, and it fucking like was a Yorgos take on that. So everyone, most everyone knew what they were getting into, but the guy next to me was like, no, I heard him say that, and he got up and walked out.
He's like, all right, I'm a head out.
It wasn't as bad as when I saw Bo Is Afraid. There was a lot of walkouts in that one, but this one still had like, I think I saw two or three. So
two or three.
I was on the verge of walking out of Bo Is Afraid because, like, you know, I really liked Hereditary, Midsommar, and I was like, all right, this is gonna be awesome. And then I'm watching it, and I'm like, what? Huh? And then this giant penis showed up.
Dude,
I'm like, what the fuck?
Not to get into the weeds on that one, but that was a movie where, you know, most times when I see people walk out of movies, it's like, come on, like, give it a chance. But that movie, I went and saw it alone pretty late. And as people walked out, I was like, yeah, I get it. Yeah, I see you. I loved it, like, by the way. I loved it, but I get it.
After Blake told me, because I still haven't seen it, because I was planning on it, you know, Ari Aster and Joaquin Phoenix, I was like, damn, that's gonna be cool. And Blake told me how he felt about it. I was like, nah, it's gonna hurt. I don't want it to hurt. So I'm gonna pass for now.
That movie pissed me off so bad. Like, you have no idea. But anyways, getting back to Poor Things. Like, you know, it was a packed theater, and like going into it, I had no idea what this movie was about. And I like doing that with movies. I like being surprised. You know, I see like a TV spot or a trailer or social media advertisements, and I'm like, I'm sold. I'm sold on the aesthetics. I'm sold on the director. I'm sold on the talent. I'm going to go see it and then find out what the story is about. And based on the imagery, you know, like you said, Dave, it seemed whimsical. Really, all I knew about it was like, okay, there's this mad scientist guy. He makes like a female Frankenstein monster.
Yeah.
We'll see what happens. And then I was very surprised with what I watched. I was like, oh, this is not at all what I expected.
100%. You know,
if I was a time traveler, if I had a TARDIS or a DeLorean, I was going back in time to like 2007, and I told younger me, hey, by the way, you see that actress, Emma Stone, you're going to see her full frontal for like a good chunk of a movie as she has sex with the Incredible Hulk.
Yeah.
I would be like, huh? What? No.
What the hell happened? How did we get there?
Dude, and that was happening.
Yeah, that was definitely something I was not prepared for. Like, I figured there was going to be at least a little bit, but...
Well, yeah, I guess not to get into the weeds yet on that, but still the same. I was like, okay. And then it kept going. It's like, oh. And then it kept going. It's like, oh, wow. Oh, yeah, we're going for it.
And then we see a lot of dick. A lot of dicks.
You know, this is a what is the term? My brain is falling apart.
Discriminate.
No discrimination of genitalia here. Thank you, Dave. Can't do this without you.
I know.
I am a straight man, but like every time I see a movie or a TV show and we get like obligatory like tit shots or like naked women, I'm like, okay, where's the dudes?
Yeah. Look, give the guy some love.
Get some equality over here. Like when I saw Game of Thrones, like I was a little bit late on the train for a couple years, and like I saw the South Park parody where they're making fun of George R. R. Martin with like, and then he starts flopping his wiener all over Tyrion. So I was like, okay, I heard there's a lot of naked men. All right, I could deal with it. And then there's like no dicks. There's like three dicks in the whole series. And I bet you they weren't even real dicks.
It's so disappointing.
Not nearly enough peni.
Yeah, no. This isn't Saltburn levels of dick, but it's definitely lots of dicks. And God bless America for that.
Yeah.
I recommended Saltburn to you because I gave you three options. One of them was Saltburn. The other one was Poor Things. I forget the third one. And Dave was like, yeah, I just watched Saltburn. You know, I'm not feeling it. And I was like, it's probably that end scene with a huge hang.
My
he had a huge
part.
Hang.
I was like, honestly, came around to the movie.
If that's real, good for you, man.
good for you, Barry. I honestly liked that movie, but like only in retrospect, because the whole time in like watching, I'm like, I'm so uncomfortable.
Right.
I loved it, but I did give Dave the choice. He's like, okay, it's either Poor Things or Saltburn. And I was like, I like them both. You choose, buddy. So he chose the one that I can't rewatch, and I've only seen once in theater, but my memory is still holding up in my advanced stage.
Here's the thing. So both films had a lasting impression on me. Poor Things, you know, it's the story behind it, and what the film is saying is what really lasted all of these weeks later of seeing it in theaters. Mm-hmm. Saltburn, however, the end credits song is what stuck in my brain. Nothing about the plot or the movie or the beautiful cinematography. Just the end song.
Just that end song.
It's been stuck in my head. And I think a lot of people's heads, too.
Yeah, speaking of celebratory endings, I'll tell you what. I love the movie, but I am glad we're talking about Poor Things because I think it comes out to streaming here very soon. And I can't wait. I cannot wait to watch Poor Things again.
I can't wait to own it. You know, I want to own it on Steelbook. I want like a shrine to Poor Things. I have a giant Midsummer poster behind me.
Yes.
I would easily swap it out with Poor Things.
I agree with that, actually.
Yeah, I'm on board.
So getting back into Poor Things, I want to dive into it. We were beating around the bush. Let's jump into it. Dave, I heard you are volunteering as tribute to do a plot synopsis of Poor Things. Could you give us a general idea of what Poor Things is all about?
I sure will. We're going to meet Godwin Baxter, a doctor who seems perfectly normal as long as you don't look at or speak to him. Dr. God has a unique hobby, mutilation of living beings. His latest creation, a grown woman with a baby brain. Watch as she travels the world while she grows into her body and experiences life's many joys. Knowledge, sex, love, sex, pain of loss, sex, independence, and please, for the love of God, don't forget, sex.
So much
masterfully done. Oh my god, that's amazing. That's so incredible, but it's true. Like like I said, I had no idea what this movie was about. And little did I expect a female, feminine, sexual liberation movie. Mm-hmm. And that's just one aspect of the film.
Oh, yeah.
Absolutely, yeah. One in which we're all very qualified to discuss.
I know.
Please let us three men talk to you about this woman's liberation movie.
Yes, let's begin mansplaining.
Yeah,
let's, so Blake,
let's explain to you, ladies. You'll get it. You'll get it.
So this film, like, there's so many layers to it aesthetically. Mm-hmm. So like, mm-hmm. we have Willem Dafoe's character. He's like the Dr. Frankenstein, Dr. Godwin Baxter. And what's interesting is that Emma Stone's character calls him short nickname God, mm-hmm. and yes. that's very apropos. yeah. to their relationship, because, like, you know, the film opens with Emma Stone's character. She plays kind of two characters, and, like, she yeah. jumps off a bridge, and that's, like, the cold open pretty much to the film, mm-hmm. and we're left like, well, what's happening? And then we find out that, like Dave said, Godwin took, because she was pregnant at the time of her suicide, took the brain of a baby and transplanted it into the grown woman's body, her head. And we're watching Bella, the main character, yeah. played by Emma Stone, grow up before our eyes in accelerated rates. And let me tell you, it was weird. And I loved every single minute of it.
It was so weird. Because, like, I enjoyed the whole plot of the movie, but I just kept thinking, like, why not just raise the baby?
I think he did mention something easy. About, yeah, the baby not, like, being able to make it, but the brain yeah. was pretty okay.
The baby wasn't cooked long enough.
Yeah, yeah.
A few more minutes in the oven.
Yeah.
A few more minutes. We're just a little short of that. But
the oven lost power. We had to put the brain into the other, but you get it.
Yeah, shut up. Don't ask questions. It is, but to your point, Armand, I'm the same way. You know, I might not necessarily be interested in the exact plot, but I see a little bit of marketing or a director that I like, I'm gonna go see it because I trust their ideas and their vision. So no idea what we're getting into, and the movie starts and we see the opening scene, and then we find out that the brain, you know, was implanted into Bella, the baby's brain was implanted into Bella's body, and my first thought was, oh no. Oh buddy. Oh, I don't like where this is going.
This is
going to
be weird.
This makes me itch a little, and I don't know why.
Well, thankfully, it didn't get weird. Well, I mean, it was weird, but it didn't get, like,
it wasn't
what you're
dark.
Alluding to.
Right. It didn't get as dark as I thought it was going to.
Yeah.
Although, there is a big sect of people, I don't know if it's big, but there is a sect of people online who are essentially saying that most of this movie was pedophilia. Because no. it was a child brain.
No.
I'm like, that's not how that.
Okay, would you like to explain, play devil's advocate, what are they saying? Because I 100% don't agree with that take.
I mean, no, I don't either, but they're saying because it's by the point in the movie where Bella Baxter discovers her body and starts pleasuring herself and then starts sleeping with men, she is like the equivalent of like a 10 to 13 year old little girl.
Yeah.
In her brain. So the people are saying, like, that we're seeing pedophilia on screen. It's just that her body is older than it.
No. Okay. Here's the thing. I'm going to make a comparison to like Boba Fett in episode two, the Attack of the Clones, best Star Wars movie ever made. So Jango Fett created a clone of himself and he wanted it to be accelerated in age. And I feel like Bella's character also has that trait as well, because, like, if she were to, so as a baby brain in, like, let's say she's like in her late 20s, early 30s. Mm-hmm. So if she were to age normally, like, she would be, you know, in her 60s by the time she reaches her original body's age. So, right. like, there has to be some sort of acceleration going on. Mm-hmm. And we see that through the film where she's learning to walk. She's learning to talk. She's learning to be aware of her surroundings. She's learning language. And that's only in a matter of weeks, maybe a month. Like, she's aging, you know, very quickly. So
right.
I think she was actually older than maybe 10 or 13 mm-hmm. by the time she had that sexual awakening.
Yeah, I agree.
But also, I think that's that interpretation is like reading this film so literally. And right. I don't think, far be it from me to say the intentions necessarily of Yorgos Lanthimos, but I can pretty goddamn guarantee that the intention was not to take this film literally.
No, you know? Exactly.
It's a fantastical, whimsical film, and I don't think it's like also glorifying it. It's not like it's like, hey, look at this. Look how great this whole thing is. Like it does show the darkness of those situations mm-hmm. and the reality of it through this fantastical lens. And so to read it that literally, I think is so short-sighted.
Yeah.
And this is the entire point of that segment of the film.
I agree. Yeah. I agree. It's definitely that's a take slash theory of this movie by people who didn't get it for sure.
Yeah, I mean, I agree. Yes. Because everybody can have their own interpretation, of course, but I just think that's the wrong one.
Your opinion is wrong.
Yeah, we're all entitled to our opinions. Yours is just wrong.
Yeah, sorry. Some are just worse than others. Because, like, I think what Yorgos was trying to convey is that Bella being born again, essentially, because, like, mm-hmm. she has a second chance at life because, like, the mother killed herself, and then Godwin was like, I'm going to resurrect her using the brain of the child, and then the child grows within the body of this woman. Mm-hmm. I think that's awesome because like it creates a blank slate for Bella because like...
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
I don't know. Well, we do know what happened with the mother because she was in a horrific, abusive relationship with this with this guy, which led her to kill herself. So she was deeply depressed, among other things. But what's interesting about Bella is that she's a blank slate. And what I mean by that is like she is not influenced at all by the society in which she grew up in or that she's in, rather, because like the mother was led to suicide because of the horrors of the society that she's in. You know, it could be, I don't know, I guess we could say patriarchy, but like what's interesting about Bella is that she has a new lease on life and she isn't influenced by anything. And she is just living life to the max. And she's living life how she wants to live life, and how she wants to live life is part of it being sexually liberated.
Yes.
Yeah. And like we talk about the, like the nature versus nurture thing, and this is definitely an exploration of that. And I think my favorite thing about that kind of arc is not knowing what the mother's life was really like until we get to the end when Bella's a fully formed human, and we get to see the differences between her mother and her mother's life and society and how she grew up to be. And like that juxtaposition is like, oh, hits you right in the heart, because like, oh man, so many different circumstances could have led to, you know, her mother, you know, not being in a place where she felt like she had to, you know, take her own life. Mm-hmm. Whereas Bella is like this fully autonomous, you know, essentially liberated woman who's going after what she wants, and and she's going to get it by almost any means necessary.
Yes. What Bella wants, Bella fucking gets.
Bella gets. She may even punch a baby. I don't know.
If she wants to eat an entire cake, by God, she's going to do it.
She's going to do it.
Mm-hmm. If she needs money and she likes sex, she's going to work in a brothel.
Yeah.
Fuck it.
It's like, wow, these things intersect? Screw it. I'm doing it.
Yeah.
I can get paid for doing what I love. Okay.
Oh, my God. But I want to unpack that a little bit with all of the male figures in her life, because like there's three main ones.
Yeah.
We have Mark Ruffalo's character, Duncan, who is betrothed to Bella. Like, it was originally another guy, Max, who's like a really sweet guy nice and very respectful towards Bella. And Bella saw Duncan and was like, I want to fuck him. It's like that meme with like the virgin nerd and like the Chad like buff guy. It's like Max is like the really nice guy, and then Duncan comes up like, okay, Bella, let's go to Libsyn or wherever, Paris. And she was like, yeah, I'm gonna go with him. I'll come back for you, Max, but I want to be with Duncan for a little bit. He's like, what? Huh? Okay. Yes, that's fine. But
I think it's really fascinating, like Duncan's character in particular. I think he's played fantastically by Mark Ruffalo. He's so funny. And I think you kind of know this guy. Everybody kind of knows this guy a little bit. And he's kind of controlling. He's a womanizer. He takes what he wants. But he's used to having the upper hand on women, whether it's societally or just that's how it has worked for him before. He's never met anybody like Bella, which is great for him at first, until he realizes what that means, which is that he can't control her. Like his nature of controlling women is so quickly put to the test. Mm-hmm. And when Bella just does whatever she wants, you know, she's going to fuck whoever she wants. She's going to eat whatever she wants. She's going to go wherever she wants.
Oh, yeah.
And those things, when he realizes he can't control her, it brings him to his literal knees.
Oh, yeah.
And it's so funny because he just turns into this puddle of a man who is obviously deeply insecure and is just immediately broken by a strong woman who just does whatever she wants.
Yeah. It's all a facade.
It is.
It's like he loses his damn mind.
It's so funny. I love it. And just his like descent into essentially depression and like gambling and alcoholism and stuff. Mm-hmm. It's like, buddy, I know this is unspecified times, but see a therapist. See anybody. Get some help for that.
I just really love how when it starts, he's so confused. He's like, why is nothing I'm doing working? What? Why are you doing this thing? Why do I want you to keep doing these things?
I know. He didn't like realize what he got himself into. He was like, oh, perfect. I can like have this woman to control because like she's naive and doesn't know any better. Oh, perfect. Mm-hmm. And then what he didn't realize was she just wants to do whatever she wants to do. She's not going to be tamed. And that's the complete opposite of what he wanted. And what's interesting about like Duncan and Max is like, yeah, they are two polar opposites, but like they're kind of like also the inverse of each other. Like on the outside, you know, Duncan seems like a very strong, stoic guy, but on the inside, he's like super deeply insecure, like you said, Blake. Yeah. And then like Max on the outside, he looks like he's super deeply insecure, but on the inside, you know, like concrete fortitude of security of himself, and like he respects Bella at the same time.
I love Max's character because I think what really hit me about it, I did think it was kind of weird when he asked her to marry him, you know, pretty early when she was like nine mentally and stuff. I was like, oh, okay. He was like, I guess, you know, he was like respectful about it. Of course, he never like was intimate with her or anything. But when she decides to go on her journeys, he's like, but, and she's like, bye. And he goes, okay, I guess. And then, but as soon as she comes back, you know, she comes back to him and they like walk along like the lake or a creek and stuff. And they have a talk Mm-hmm. She's like, I'm not going to stop doing like these things that I love and this things. And this is how my life's going to be. And he goes, okay, I support that. That's cool with me. And he goes, is it okay if I do this? She goes, yeah, you can do whatever. And he's like, great. Wow. Look at this. We're talking. We're two people who know who we each other are. And wow. We're talking about it.
We're adults.
It's
here.
Just like,
we're all adults.
Beautiful.
You worked in a brothel? Yeah. What was that like? Duncan would be like, oh, Bella, no, please.
I mean, how many times did Duncan call Bella a whore or something?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Whereas to Max is like, yeah, cool, make some money.
Yeah, how much money did you make?
Or, do you, can we share?
Yeah,
or...
what's that whole thing?
This sounds like a win-win for me.
It's like today's equivalent would be like, oh, you have an OnlyFans? Sick. can you buy me stuff?
Yeah. No. What's your tax bracket these days with that?
So you're saying you could buy me a PlayStation 5. Is that what you're saying right now?
I could really use some new shoes.
Oh, my God, guys. But, yeah, I really – and, like, let's talk about the third dude because, like, when – Bella was with Max. I was like, oh, yes, the happy ending. The movie's coming to an end. And then out of nowhere, literally, she's like on the altar about to marry Max.
Yeah.
Dude comes in and is like, that's my wife. Like, pops in out of nowhere.
This? Oh.
Is his name Alfie?
Yeah, I believe so.
Yeah,
this
was Alfie. Mm-hmm.
This was hard. I was like, no, stop
it. Who the fuck's this guy?
Yeah, and, like, I get – she did say, like, I'm going to go wherever I'm going to go. And Max is at the altar, like, well, just – okay, well, okay, bye, I guess. And so she goes with him. You know, it's Bella's mother's husband. She goes back to live with him.
Yeah.
And this guy sucks. Like, if we thought Duncan was a piece of shit, which he definitively is, he just needs a little more mental help. This guy is insane. This guy needs to be in an institution.
Yes. And not one of his own making, where he threatens his own fucking staff.
Yes. Yeah. With a gun.
With a gun.
Like, it's nothing. He just, like, I think it was like, oh, my God. Yeah, it was like the waiter, maid. He's bringing the food at the dinner scene, and like he just casually pulls out a gun.
Yep.
And I'm like, this is a joke, right? This is a joke, right?
No, that's how you treat your staff, guys.
Oh, yeah.
It's so right, wild. Actually. It's like this gets right back to like that dichotomy I was talking about earlier of like Bella's like quote unquote former life or who her mom was. Mm-hmm. This guy is, what is he, like a I don't know. He's like a baron or something. Like,
it's like a not constable, not a colonel, commodore. I think it's commodore.
Okay,
I think some sort of like admiral thing.
He's a very like high up, like kind of like military guy with lots of money and staff. High society man, and this dude is insane. And he's talking about how like, oh, remember the old times when we used to just mutilate and horribly abuse our staff. That was a laugh riot. Remember that? Where
that was a knee slapper.
Yeah. And I'm just like, oh my God. And you see Bella like, yo, that's really fucked up. Like, what the hell? Who was I? Who was my mother? Who are these people? And then you just realize the unrelenting cruelty that her mother's life was. And you can see how she was driven to, you know, kill herself.
Right.
It's just horrible cruelty, and it kind of like the way it's presented is like, again, kind of like whimsical, this crazy guy, this crazy rich guy. And then it's like, oh, he's like killing people and like, yeah, mutilating people. And it's dark. It's fucking so dark. But she was curious. Right. So she's like, well, I'm going to check this thing. I'm just going to see you. I'm just going to go down this path for a minute. See how that ends up.
Yeah. Bella is essentially a cat.
She's kind of like a cat. Kind of like my cat. Yes.
She embraces the chaos. She was like, you know what? I just want to do whatever I want, just like a cat.
Exactly.
It feels like she has zero impulse control at all and loves that about herself.
Right.
That's true. But like Dave, I think we talked about this a little bit. Mm-hmm. I feel like you kind of mentioned something about this scene and how that cruelty kind of played into like her ultimate like redemption.
Yes. It was. I don't know how to really verbalize how I like felt watching that scene, but her going through this, I think she had kind of resigned to like, yeah, I'm just gonna go ahead and live my life, you know, however I want, in whatever way I want. And seeing and interacting with this guy, she's like, maybe I need a bigger purpose than what I was thinking. And I think I'm going to start with him, and I'm going to follow my quote unquote father, Dr. God's footsteps.
Yeah.
Into, you know, being a mutilating doctor.
Yeah. Cause like we didn't mention like the doctor, Dr. Godwin, he was kind of like a Dr. Moreau where he like,
yeah,
attaches humans to like animals or different animals to different animals, like, yes. He made like this like a dog goose thing, a dog with a goose head
and a pig duck, I think. Yeah. There was one.
I'm like, crazy. What? I mean, this was like in the early, you know, beats of the film, and I'm like, I'm here for it. It's filmed in black and white, 35 millimeter fisheye lens, the vignette around, and I'm like, I'm here. I like super weird avant-garde shit, and this is right up my alley.
What's cool about the beginning shots is, I forget who pointed this out to me, but throughout the movie, not only does it switch from black and white to color, but the shots start getting more, they start out very like weird and cool, interesting angles, and it starts getting more and more like standard, like mid shots. And then the backgrounds start looking more and more real and less like a cartoon as she's growing into a full-fledged adult again. And I thought that was such a cool touch that Yorgos put on this film.
Do you think it's because Yorgos is visually showing Bella's cognitive development before our eyes, where, you know, yeah, as a baby, you know, things are kind of abstract and weird and black and white and pretty choppy, kind of like, you know, it's a new brain. It's developing. It's not going to know what it's looking at. And then as she's aging, it's becoming more and more standard cinematic language that we're seeing on screen.
Yeah, I 100%. I think that's what that is, especially with, you know, her brain growing more into the adult, like full-fledged brain. She's understanding more the things that are happening around her, which is, you know, what represented visually by less cartoony things, like when she's on the boat and it's like the green smoke just like pouring out and the sky is very weird, but then eventually you can just tell, like, oh, she's in a park and it's just a normal park, and she's in this church for a normal wedding, and this, like, it eventually is like normal. And yeah, I think the coolest part is when she's in the general evil asshole his mansion, that part is very dull. It's colored very dull, and then the coloration gets really bright and vibrant again when she's home after having turned him into Goat Man.
It is very, like, what I like too about the opening sequence is because it is, you know, a lot in black and white, and even when it turns to color, everything is like whimsical, but it's also very inconsistent. Like, there's just some ultra wide, like fisheye shots. Some things are straight, like, you know, Dr. God, like, burps bubbles and things. Like, there's so many weird things, but it's also inconsistent within its weirdness, which does feel disorienting, like when you're a kid. And yeah, right, by the time we get to the very end, it feels like it's shot like a, you know, in color, like a standard drama, like the coldness and realness of life. Her, even her discovering her kind of purpose after killing Alfie and stuff, she's like, yeah, like, that's my purpose. It's still like, it's very real and very, like you said, kind of standard in its approach. But you kind of do get a little bit of that, like, thinking about the beginning, you get to see and feel how far she's really come. Yep. I think those changes as you go really highlight and give you the feeling of like seeing somebody living their entire life, but I guess within the span of the movie, you know, a few years.
That stark contrast when she is with the third dude, the asshole, in his mansion, the Commodore. There is that stark contrast between, you know, the earlier in the film where it's really weird and fantastical, and even in Paris, it's still slightly weird and exaggerated.
Yeah.
When we get to her being this dude's wife again, we have that stark contrast. Do you think possibly it could be symbolizing a loss of innocence where it's like, oh, shit is real now. And that's I need to figure out how to get out of this situation.
Yeah,
that's a great point, because I was trying to think again. I've only seen this movie once a couple months ago, but there is that kind of almost definitive point. Yeah, where there is a bit more of a switch. It felt a little more gradual leading up to it, but I think a lot of things really did change kind of like in Paris, and it shit became a little more real. So I think that's a good point, actually.
Yeah, I think it's a brilliant point, actually, because this is the first time in the movie where she's like, oh, there are some consequences to things that I do. Yeah. And it's the first time where even though she gets them kicked off a boat and they have no money and she has to work in a brothel, she's like, I'll find a way. Everything has a way. It's fine. Mm-hmm. This is the first time she's like, ah, yes, life can do things back to you. And she knew, like, if I don't find a way out of this, then I am screwed.
Yeah, because she almost comes from privilege leading up to that. And then all of a sudden, that privilege is gone. She's nobody in a place that is essentially nowhere to her. Mm-hmm. And now she's like, well, shit. I don't just have money. I don't just have these things. I have to earn them. And just like you said, Dave, life can do things back to me.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's a great point. I really also resonated with the scenes that led up to this. Her discovering in Alexandria that there's poor and destitute people.
Oh, yeah.
You know, she's on this boat with, like, you know, the dandies of the era. And they're all, you know, dressed, and they have this overflowing bowls and drinks, and they can kind of do whatever they want.
Right.
And they have the time to discuss philosophy and the meaning of all this stuff. And then she, like, looks over the ship when they're in Alexandria, and it's like, oh, there's people dying of hunger and exposure and, like, starvation and stuff. And she goes, oh, we should help them.
Right.
But then goes about it, you know, she doesn't have the maturity and, like, worldview enough to understand that she can't just give her money to these guards and that they'll distribute the wealth for her and stuff. I really related to that. And I remember, you know, when I was a kid, and you see a homeless person, and I remember, like, why can't we just give them money? Why can't we just give them a ride to wherever they need to go? Why can't we just give them a house? And then, you know, asking all these questions and being put off for so long by my parents, like, oh, well, you know, you never know. And then when you're confronted with, like, the awful complexities of, like, the systems that lead people to be unhoused, as an 8-year-old, you're like, oh, oh no, I don't get this at all. How will we ever solve this problem? And Bella's, we get to see her confront that too, and it ends up, you know, making her essentially unhoused and making her have to scrap for what she needs.
Right. Yeah. Like, clearest picture of, like, people, like, the haves and the have-nots, because, like, she's in this lavish, you know, opulent world, and then literally outside of the walls she's in, she looks down and she sees people, like you said, literally dying. And yeah, it's kind of like that Prince Siddhartha moment, Buddha, where he goes outside the walls and sees destitute people for the first time. It's like, whoa, these people exist. She doesn't know about this.
Yeah.
Because, like, she's a blank slate. She is not influenced at all about the on the society she's in, because like, she hasn't been outside of Godwin's laboratory. Like, this is all brand new for her. She doesn't know anything. And all those little tiny things, like, she sees poverty for the first time. Then she goes to Paris and she is experiencing poverty, and she has to figure out, oh, I need to make money somehow. Oh, I'm beautiful. Let me use my body and make money that way, and starts working in a brothel. Then she has power again. She has power because she has money and also influence over men.
Yeah.
And then all of that's taken away with this asshole husband character.
Just like that.
Yeah. And then now she's like, I need to get out of here, because if I don't, I will literally die. Because, like, he was talking about it. He's like, yep, I'm going to kill her. I'm going to kill her now. It's going to be a pool of blood right here. It's going to be a dead body. Got to kill her.
I think on some level she's like, because she knew how her mom died, whose body she has, and she was like, oh, I'm gonna do the same thing if I have to stay here.
Right.
I'm not doing that.
Right. Yeah, there's a sense of, like, generational trauma. trying to break. She's trying to break it.
I think she's really trying to, like, she's really realizing too, like, hey, like, I can't just, like, do this one thing and now everything's going to be fine. It's like constant work that has to be done, because she's also studying to be like a surgeon throughout this, like, as she's working at the brothel and all these things. She's like also studying to just be like God, like a surgeon and all this stuff. And so she's like, oh, I can't ever stop growing or learning. I have to keep doing this, otherwise I'm gonna be impoverished, essentially imprisoned, or be so out of touch that I can't help anybody. And it's like, regardless of, you know, the womanhood aspect, I think for all people, anybody watching this, kind of, you kind of understand, like, yeah, there's no real resting. You kind of always have to be pushing yourself and always have to be learning to get anything out of life. It's hard and it's miserable, but you can do it.
I really enjoyed her, Bella, breaking the generational trauma, because I didn't even think about it like that. Mm-hmm. But she was like, after everything she's been through, she has learned enough about life and about what she doesn't want. Mm-hmm. And the fact that it's her being like, no, I'm going to go ahead and break off this trauma and live a life worth living.
Yeah.
Yeah. I thought it was great.
This ends here. Because, like, say her mom didn't commit suicide and she lived.
Yeah.
Bella, or whoever, whatever her name was going to be, she would have been growing up in the same conditions of her mom. So then she would become like her mom. Mm-hmm.
Yes.
It's the same society she's living in. It's the same household she's living in. Like, all of, like, the nurturing aspects of what made her mom suicidal is going to make her suicidal as well.
Right.
That's where the generational trauma is. It's this endless cycle. And Godwin giving her the blank slate once again, breaks it. Because, like, it's like, I know nothing of the past. It ends with me. And then she's in this situation. She's like, oh. Boom. It's like the mind-blown moment. It's like, oh, my God, this is why.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable, too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
This is why my mom had problems.
Yeah.
It's so
I need
good.
To kill this
and,
guy.
And even with, like, even, like, Godwin's arc, I think is interesting too, within, like, the generational and, like, parental roles, I guess, because he's like, I'm not her father. I'm just a scientist. I brought her to life and she's my experiment. And he keeps resisting against this. But for as long as this goes on, he realizes, like, I guess I can't really deny that this is a human life. This is a life that I brought and I do care about it. You know, as much as I want that separation, I really care about this. And it's almost like, you know, some parents where they, yeah, like they have their 9 to 5, they have the house or whatever. Now I have to have kids, and you have a kid and it's like, okay, you're a kid, you know, good luck. I'll be here to pay your bills for a while until you, you know, you fuck off. But he's realizing, like, oh, this isn't just an experiment. This is somebody that I care for. And I think seeing, like, the paternal instincts kick in within him is really cool. And really, like, enhances Bella's trajectory by the end. Mm-hmm. He kind of leans into his father role. She's her own person with a purpose. And she kind of becomes whole within her own little found family.
Yes.
Oh, yeah.
And also, speaking of the way that Dr. Godwin is and treats Bella and stuff, I think one of my favorite parts, and to me one of the funniest, is when Max is like, oh, well, were you fucking her? And Dr. Godwin's like, he could have just been like, that's disgusting. No, she's like my child. But no, he's like, no, I don't have the physical ability to even get an erection or have an orgasm. And it's like they go on this, like, he goes on this like 3-minute tirade about how his dick doesn't work. And you're like, Jesus Christ.
Yorgos gonna Yorgos.
Amazing.
Oh my God.
Yeah. It's so good.
Everything about him, he's like the Elephant Man. Like, like all of these, yes. Like, he's like a puzzle piece.
Yeah.
It's amazing. And then, like, his gastrointestinal system also doesn't work. That's why he's burping these stomach acid things.
And I love how he just talks about how his dad just, like, mutilated and abused him as if it's like, oh, yeah, we went to the park and took a walk.
Yeah, somebody also dealing with generational trauma that he does not understand at all, normalizes completely.
Oh, God.
I mean, but to mentioning the Elephant Man, I thought about this when I left. I was like, this movie feels like David Lynch's Edward Scissorhands to a degree. Like, Edward Scissorhands is very stylized.
Yeah.
But I would say this is weirder and, like, you know, more specific in tone, I guess. And obviously, Edward Scissorhands is like a created character, and not to knock Tim Burton's vision, but this feels like the kind of more depraved version of that in a way. And I loved it.
Depraved? This movie?
The more the more adult Edward Scissorhands.
Yeah.
Fuck, man. Like, there was more action in this movie than 50 Shades of Grey.
There was. It was such a sexual movie. But like, I do love how they... they brought in humor and decided to bring some levity with calling it Furious Jumping. And
it's so funny. Furious and as much jumping. As this movie, I think, is a sexual movie, I would never call this movie a sexy movie.
No.
Not even once.
No.
I don't even know what gaze this movie would even be in, because, like, it's so weirdly shot.
Yes.
Yeah. Even the sex scenes are weirdly shot. And Yorgos, I don't know what's going through your mind. So you have an eye like that. It's like, okay, and then we're going to zoom in right here. We're going to use a fisheye lens. And I'm like, like, it's intriguing and unnerving at the same time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's weird.
I fully agree. Yeah, it's intriguing, but also not enticing.
No,
at all.
No,
I'm never like, wow, this is getting me going or anything like that. It's like, oh, Jesus.
It's almost like cinema verite. Like it's almost a slice of life. If it was like still heightened reality and still like weirdly presented, but it still seems grounded at the same time.
Yeah, that's actually that's a really, really, really freaking great point. Really great point. As stylized as the entire production and everything is, those moments, and a lot of moments of this film, are very real. They feel very verite, like you're just kind of getting a hint in on like what's just the conversation, and a lot like normal conversations, they kind of dip and duck and dovetail into other things and other scenarios as Bella's brain kind of develops. So she's you know, having sex 1 minute, and then she's like, okay, well, I'm gonna go get food. And he's like, I need to sleep. And she's like, okay, do that. I don't care. I'm hungry now. Like, I don't care. So that's where I think you're dead on. It's just things do happen, and you do get those slice of life moments within this grand, whimsical, you know, exterior.
Because I think of that scene, it was on the boat, she was in the bedroom, and I think it was Mark Ruffalo's character was talking to her, and like it was shot flat and like she would just like undress, but like not in a sexy way. It was just like a matter of fact way of her removing her clothes. And it's like, what's happening right now?
I will say that being a, you know, an Emma Stone mega fan and having a celebrity crush on her, I will admit it. This did not do anything for me. This movie, I was so uncomfortable when they were having the furious jumping scenes, because, like you said, it wasn't meant to be anything other than like a matter of fact, like, this is happening.
right.
type scenes when she does just like, oh, like when Duncan gets mad at her and leaves the room, and she goes, the using your tongue on me, is that not happening?
Oh. Oh my god. Like, it reminded me, like, scenes like that reminded me of, like, The Favourites, because which also stars Emma Stone.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And, like, those scenes, no.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Like, the Favourite made me deeply uncomfortable. And, again, I watch a lot of weird stuff, but I remember watching it, you know, for the first time, and I was like, oh, boy, there's so much going on that makes me feel so incredibly uncomfortable.
And I went into that movie blind as well. Walked into the theater. I'm like, all right, this is like a period piece. Mm-hmm. And then it turned into this weird fucked up love triangle. And I was like, what? All right, let's do this. Fuck it. This is weird. I'm here for it.
I do think this is probably, I think Dave and I discussed this as well. This feels like the most straightforward like, Yorgos Lanthimos like film narratively that I think I've seen, and I think I've seen pretty much all of his films, but this feels like the most straightforward one in my head,
the most conventional one.
Like, I guess obviously, in the core base of what happens in the story, it's almost linear. You know, mm-hmm. it's like one thing happens after another, and so that felt like a slight departure from previous Yorgos films. But I think he was able to hide that really well. I won't say he did it on purpose, but to hide the straightforwardness of the movie with the shots, the coloring, the laughing at the ridiculousness that is happening on the screen 90% of the movie to make it feel less straightforward. And I don't know, I just really enjoyed that.
Maybe he really wants that Oscar. He's like, you know what?
Really going for it.
Let me make my Oscar movie.
I'm like, honestly, I think Blake, you and I might have talked about this. I was shocked to see that it was nominated for any awards, and that in the which ones did it win?
Are you crazy? I'm not shocked at all. I'm like, it should sweep.
I mean,
you get all the awards.
I agree. Well, that's the thing. That's what we talked about. Like when they started like announcing Oscar stuff, and even with the Golden Globes. Not that I don't think it deserved those things, because I do, but I just thought when I first saw it, I was like, oh, this is more of an art film that people are more like general audiences and stuff are really not going to be about as much. And the amount of nominations it did get, I expected it to get nominated for like, you know, production design and things like that, you know, costuming. But to see some of the like bigger or other accolades rather that's getting nominated for, I was like, thank God. Faith restored a little bit. Not that I love awards ceremonies and shows, but to a degree, I was like, wow, art is getting appreciated on a pretty big scale.
Yeah, it's about time. Agreed. And with that sentiment, let's get off the fence on a few questions.
Sure.
Which will lead me to my first one. Are the normies finally getting into art house films?
Ooh.
That's a great question. That's a really, really great question.
As a normie, I will say, as a reformed normie, if you will,
reformie.
Thank you, Blake. I want to say they're more open to it. Mm. I don't think they're quite on board yet. I think Poor Things was a great, like, bridge for a lot of people. Mm-hmm. We saw it with our friend Isaac, who hadn't seen Yorgos film before, I think. And he's more of a I know he likes a lot of art films too, but I think he could be considered more of a normie, I guess. And he came out of that like, the fuck did I just watch?
But with the biggest smile on his face.
Yeah. He loved it, but he was like, I'm so, what did we just watch? And then I think we were driving back somewhere to pick up Mo to go to my car or whatever. And we had to drop him off, and we were talking about something, and he just all of a sudden goes, I just can't stop thinking about it. So I would like to think that this Poor Things was a great like offering of the hand of art films to people who don't like art films, because it was marketed in a way to get people in the door, and then they were so intrigued by it that they you're like, maybe I'll see more of films like this.
Yeah. And again, drawing that comparison to Everything Everywhere All at Once, mm-hmm. like, the marketing got people in the door, but it's an unhinged film that I love so deeply. And once you're there, you're just like, what? Huh? Oh my gosh. And you're mm-hmm. like overcome with all these emotions and all this stuff. And I think this is a similar thing where, you know, not that I love marketing people, and I think films are marketed terribly often, but I think getting people into this, see this film in a theater, there's no distractions. You're forced to engage with the narrative in front of you, mm-hmm. and people responded to it. So I think it was, I agree with Dave's sentiment. I guess that is all to say. I agree with Dave. I think it's heading in that direction. People are opening up more to it. There's a lot of stale like things going on, not to shit on superhero films, like whatever you like, I don't care, but we're getting a lot of those kind of things that are just failing one after another. People are kind of getting sick of, and to see something like this in a big theater and with something to talk about, I know it's not so much a passive like drama art film, right. It's there's something to talk about here, mm-hmm. and I think it really got the conversation going in that direction and opened up a lot of people to seeing new things,
right? Because like the whole comic book movie scene fad like dominated, and now we see like the throes of like a dying genre before our eyes as Madam Web comes out and completely bombs.
Rip.
Oh my god. And like, yeah, like when that came out, I was like, what the fuck? What the fuck is this? Oh my god.
Who are these people? What is this thing?
And like when we have like the normie Marvel super fans like bitching about their own movies that they're being made for, it's like, okay, yeah. I think it's time to stop making these type of movies. And like the movies that are doing well, Everything Everywhere All at Once,
yeah,
Poor Things, like all of these weird movies that mm-hmm. general audience people are gravitating towards, it's like, okay, I hope we're on the precipice of a new revival for cinema. Because like, unfortunately, I mean, there has been awesome movies in the past like 20 or so years, but we're in a dry spell. It's like, who are like the big like actors of our time? There's not many. Like if you go back to like the 80s, 70s, 60s, hell, even the 90s, like we have like powerhouse actors.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And like now it's like, who do we have? Sydney Sweeney?
Chris Pratt. Put him in everything. Oh, that guy rules. Wow.
Please don't bring up Chris Pratt to me. I used to be a fan of him, and
I love that guy.
Woohoo. Let's go, Luigi.
Whoa.
Whoa. Take that, Bowser.
It does feel like one of those things, though. Like, I think independent cinema, I've said this, David, I probably talked about this as well. Like, I think independent cinema is starting to hit a spot again where we kind of saw in the early 90s where, you know, the Sundance crowd, like the Kevin Smiths and the Tarantinos and stuff, the Robert Rodriguez's of the world, making new, interesting, weird stuff that the general public loved. And not that I wouldn't say Yorgos Lanthimos is like an indie director necessarily, but kind of. And some of these smaller films with more niche ideas and visions are starting to get more appreciation. And so with the dying of the massive studio tentpole film that we've seen lately, I feel like we're heading in that direction of like maybe lower budget, exciting ideas getting more traction than, say, you know, Iron Man 13 or whatever the fuck, you know.
Iron Man, he's back.
Yeah, Iron Man, he's back again, baby. This time it's personal again.
Family.
I would like to say that in terms of the Marvel super fans, because I would say that I'm not a super fan. I'm a Marvel fan. I'm not a super fan, but I think it's like this perfect storm of, you know, after Avengers Endgame, right? It was such a big build up to that.
Mm-hmm.
And that was such like a climactic release of 10 years of loving characters that most people, even Marvel super fans, are like, I'm spent. And Marvel's right. like, no, we're gonna keep going. Like, no, I'm spent. Stop giving me shit. And then on top of that, we see movies like Saltburn and The Cops Coming After Me. I don't know if you guys can hear the sirens in the background.
Hey, Rod.
They found me. I don't know how they did it, but they found me.
I'm sorry, guys. End this podcast early. I'll see you later.
You're talking shit about Marvel. It's over, dog.
Bob Iger's going to get you.
No, but I think the combination of Marvel fans being absolutely just spent and movies like, you know, Poor Thing, Saltburn, Everything Ever All at Once, all these like cool artsy films that, you know, they're coming around on time is like, oh, but here's this other thing that we could be doing. It's like, I like this. Let's follow this.
Yeah.
Because like we had that thematic release. It was the end of an era. I mean, even in the, I saw it in, I think it was IMAX. I saw it opening weekend, Endgame. And like they did the credits for each one of the actors as if it was like they're done playing this role. Like it was like, this is Captain America, Iron Man. It was like, it felt like, I was like, holy shit. Like this is the end. Of superhero movies forever. Like, oh my God, how can you even top this? And then they come out with Ant-Man and the Wasp into like a Quantumania or whatever. It's like, we're still making this? Like, what? I thought we're done.
You shot your shot.
Not only are we not done, they are starting to fluff us for the X-Men and the Fantastic Four.
You shot your money shot. It's like, okay, we're done. All right, get ready for more. It's like, I'm done, man.
I need time. I need time.
What do you mean there's more?
Please, no fluffing.
Just an hour-long session fuck fest. What are you talking about? Like, I'm done. And Bella's like, more. I want more.
Stationable.
Yes, Marvel is Bella in this circumstance.
What do you mean I can't do this all day, every day? Why don't people do this all day, every day? I want to talk about the ending of the film because like we got up to it, but like the Commodore character, the husband, he got his comeuppance, thank God.
Yes.
And she did like a brain switcheroo with a goat. And that was like what we're left with the audience is like him like squawking like a goat, like, and I'm like, holy shit, this is amazing. Yorgos Lanthimos, you are the goat for doing this.
Yes. It was amazing. See, like, because, like, it's, they hinted at it pretty hard, but then immediately revealed it. And it's like, yep, I'm on board. I'm so on board for this.
Yeah.
So here's my question. Because, like, I was left with this. I was like, why didn't the director do this? And I don't know if you guys felt the same way. Because, like, Dr. Godwin, he was dying. Her father's dying.
Yeah.
And I immediately thought, okay, we're being set up for her to switch the brain of Godwin into the abusive husband's body. So then Godwin gets another lease at life, just like she did. But then we didn't get that.
That's where I thought we were going to. I had that same thought. And I was like, oh, man, this is – it made sense to me. And – what I think we got instead was the funnier ending.
Absolutely.
Which I also appreciate. To be clear, I'm not mad at the ending, but I definitely did think it was going to go that way. But before I thought it was going to go that way, I also thought it was going to go a even darker way when we're at like the Commodore's house and stuff. I was like, oh no, I've seen too much dark stuff. And I was like, if this movie ends up killing Bella's in like this tragic ending, I'm gonna riot. I'm gonna set something on fire, and I'm gonna go to prison for a felony. But
you're gonna January 6th the Oscars.
Yes, Blake's the first.
You'll be
one
there with Greta Gerwig.
Let's
take down the Academy.
I pay my taxes. Damn it! I own this place. You work for me. But thank God it didn't go that way, you know, and it went the way that I felt more hopeful with. And I don't know. I was just very nervous about that. But then, you know, when things started switching, I did think they were going to give God his lease on life. But the way I kind of read it was like, he's like, I've done a lot. I've done a lot of stuff.
Yes.
I'm like, I'm not itching to like continue my life. I feel like you're my accomplishment, Bella. And I'm so like proud of what I've done. And brought to this, you know, person, I'm cool. We're good. We got to go now.
Also, I think if they had done that, I think it would have taken away from Bella's story a little bit.
It would have. Oh, yeah. It absolutely would have.
I think that it would have been because obviously we end up focused on Bella, and now she's happy. She is, I guess, in a polyamorous relationship or something. And she's putting goat brains into she's living her life. And now it's I mean, it was the whole time, but it's like putting the nail in the coffin, the period in the sentence, the dotting of the I. This is Bella's story. And I feel like if they had continued with Godwin there, it would have distracted from that a little bit.
Yeah. Yeah, you're right. Even though I want that wholesome ending. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you two are right. He's like, I'm tired. Bella, yeah, you do your own thing. And then she's like lounging with a martini.
I love it.
Goat brain guy next to her.
Amazing.
But literally ending on that and like the credits roll. And I felt like myself smiling like a dipshit. Just like I felt so happy. Like, so I don't know. Mm-hmm. It's hard to describe that feeling because I've never seen anything quite like this, you know, tonally. And it was just so joyful despite all the highs and lows of the journey. You know, I feel like very, like, I don't know, I just felt very whole. I felt very seen in a lot of ways, and it was really great.
Because Blake too is a baby in a grown adult's body.
Yeah, spoiler alert. I was gonna come out with that later, but you know,
I'm a man child,
still a baby.
You stood up and you clapped.
Yeah, I cheered. Didn't, you know, called off the insurrection. It was great.
Yeah, I feel like the audience in our theater, I feel like it was half people going, wow, right? That was great. And half people going, wow, what was that?
Yeah. Yeah. It was like, I think I liked it. I don't know.
What's happening right now? I don't know.
Yeah.
Oh my God. Okay. So do you think this movie deserves an Oscar sweep?
Yes.
Sweep? Really? You don't think anything else deserves?
Well,
like best director or best picture? Because I think it deserves a lot of Oscar wins. I think Emma Stone would deserve best actress.
Yes.
I think that they would deserve best set design.
Costuming for sure.
Costuming cinematography. For sure. Yeah, cinematography for sure. But I feel like in terms of best picture, I don't know if it had the kind of impact that a best picture winning movie does.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
That's interesting, actually, because I saw a tremendous amount of films last year, a disgusting amount of films. And I would say, I don't know, all my favorite films from last year are all very different kinds of films.
Yes.
So talking about it now for like the last hour or so, I'm like, hell yeah. Get all the awards. Like, but thinking back to everything I saw, it's a great year for film. I guess it definitely deserves a lot of awards. It deserves a lot of recognition. It really does. I think it deserves all of its nominations. My brain's been stuck lately on The Zone of Interest, which broke me into a million little pieces. Mm. And I can't get that one out of my head. not a fun movie. But thinking back to some of these other films, too. You know, I loved Oppenheimer. I loved Barbie. I loved this movie. And there's a lot, but they all are so different.
Right. Yes, they're so different. And I think, like, listen, to be clear, I will be glad and happy of any award they do win and think they will be deserving of it. I don't think it'll sweep. I think the Academy is too much of an old boys club to not let Oppenheimer win. I don't think it should. I think it was a fantastic movie. I don't think it should win Best Picture. But Yes, to answer your question, Armand, I don't think it would sweep, but I think it would deserve to.
I agree. Like when Greta Gerwig wasn't nominated for Best Director, yet Barbie was nominated for Best Picture, I just thought of that scene in Barbie where Ken confronts the business guy. He's like, well, it sounds like you're not doing patriarchy very well. No. We are. We just hide it better now. And I was like, that's the Academy.
There it is.
Right now.
Barbie was such a perfect tightrope walk of tone that, like, you, if you don't know what the fuck you're doing as a director, I think that's an easy movie to fuck up, even with a perfect script. If you don't know what you're doing behind the camera, you will fuck that movie up.
Oh, yeah.
And I think she crushed it. So that's a travesty.
I wanted to sweep. Damn it. I wanted to sweep. I want Emma Stone to have all the Oscars.
Yeah,
she deserves it.
Yorgos deserves it. Everybody. That's the thing. Like, talking about it, everybody deserves it.
Not Nolan.
Nolan.
He's too mainstream, damn it.
Got him too big for his britches. We gotta knock him down a few pegs.
Yeah. Here's the thing I will say, because you know I am a huge Nolan fan. I think if he had, not that it's like a competition necessarily in that regard, but I think if he had put out Oppenheimer in a different year than Barbie and or Poor Things, I think that it would have not dominated the entire circuit. I think nobody else would have had a movie that would have came close to that.
I think having that contrast between the two films coming out on the same day.
Yeah.
Just, I don't know if you know this, Dave, but like when those two movies came out in that month, it was the second highest grossing month for cinema in cinema history.
Wow. Oh, shit.
So I think the meme of people wanting to see them back to back, these two like original films, not Marvel films, not superhero movies. One's a freaking documentary, a biopic, and the other is about like Barbies. It's like these two original films, and like everyone wanted to go see it. All the normies wanted to go see it.
Yeah.
It's amazing. So I think if it were to come out any other time, I think it would have been like Tenet, where no one went to the theater. I'm going to save movie theaters. And then no one wants to go see Tenet.
I have my thoughts on Tenet, but. You do have a really fascinating point, actually. I don't think it would have been as big of a movie as it is. I do think it would have gotten all the awards stuff because it is a good film with great things in it. Mm-hmm. But that hype was real. I did the Barbenheimer double feature, and I saw Oppenheimer first, which I'm glad I saw first. And by the time I got to Barbie, I was like, oh boy, I feel like shit. And then I get to Barbie and everybody's dressed up and it's like this whole thing and everybody's like just having a good time and talking with each other as strangers and complimenting each other's outfits. And I was like, this is fun.
So you did Barbie. I did Barbenheimer. I did Barbie first, then Oppenheimer.
Oh, I'm sorry.
I left depressed and I was like, holy shit. Oh my God. We're destroying the planet.
Dude. After seeing Oppenheimer first, I was like, I think I just want to go to sleep for a while, just a little bit. But I drugged, you know, my carcass to another theater because I got to see Oppenheimer on film. And then I drove across town to see Barbie and that little span of time, got a little food in my system, seeing all the joyous activity for Barbie that night, put me back together again. Felt whole.
Hi, Barbie.
Hi, Barbie.
I haven't stopped
answering the phone. Hi, Barbie. So,
yeah, it's really annoying.
Yeah, my family doesn't talk to me that much anymore.
Yeah, I'm getting there.
And anyway. Fun fact before I get to the final question, February 2024, got to have the duality going on, was the worst time for cinema in cinema history.
Oh, numbers-wise?
Numbers-wise. Month for movies in cinema history. So, like, we have the highest of highs of, like, Barbenheimer over the summer, and then the lowest of lows in the winter.
Wow.
Dude. Well, I got to say, we also got bangers throughout the entire, like, holiday season as well. And I felt like, I saw so many movies in theaters that I was like, I need a month or so off from theaters. It's been sporadic. But, yeah, man, what the hell has come out? Remember
Madam Web?
The Beekeeper.
That trailer made me laugh hysterically because I saw it before American Fiction. I saw the trailer for The Beekeeper and it was on. Jason Statham. This lady, this old lady got scammed by these guys. Now he's out for revenge. And I was like, this is hilarious. And then it kept going. And I was like, oh, it's not a joke. Is this a joke? Wait, are you joking? You're not joking. The Beekeeper. I was like, oh, no, it's not a joke.
This reminds me of a TikTok I saw where it's like every Jason Statham movie. It's like, don't you know who I am? I'm the beekeeper. It cuts to, don't you know who I am? I'm the gardener.
Oh, my God. Oh,
dude. It's just, yeah, nothing. I mean, I didn't get to see the Zone of Interest until this year, but that was a few weeks ago. And I also saw that. That was a packed theater too. Like the movie had been out forever and I like had to find a screening and I found a screening of it and I went and saw it and there was so many, that theater was full and also dead silent. Dead silent. I saw it with Isaac and the lights come up and I was like, I'm gonna fucking cry. I need to go somewhere and like be alone. And the entire theater just kind of quietly stands up. Nobody says a fucking word and just like walks out. And I was like, I'm never going to the movies again. God damn it.
Well, I can't wait for them to re-release Come and See, Salo, The Boy in the Striped Pajamas.
Oh, Jesus Christ.
No.
Don't put me through
fucking
Salo.
Pin drops. Like, oh my God.
Please.
Oh my God. Yeah. Yeah.
Rough anyways, times.
Rough times for movies. Rough times. I don't know what we're gonna do. But on a different note, would you recommend Poor Things to a friend?
No, I hate this movie. What the heck? No, like what?
Fuck this movie.
Don't go see this movie. What?
Fuck you. It's February.
I would say, depending on how old they are. Yes, and by that I mean anybody over the age of 45. I would tell said, "Don't go watch this movie. You won't get it. You won't understand it."
I disagree.
Well, your mom's an exception to the rule, Blake.
Okay, I agree with you.
No, I just mean because, like, when I recommended Everything Everywhere All at Once because of how much I loved it, and I made my mom like want to watch it, she got like 20 minutes in to turn it off. And that's how I feel about Poor Things, where I'm like, yes, everyone should see this movie. Go watch it. And I just know that there's going to be some people that will for sure turn it off.
I think the boomers would actually like this because it's also filmed pretty traditional. Even the weird segments is still filmed pretty traditional, like an old 1930s Hammer film or like Boris Karloff is coming out. They'd be like, I remember this one. It's on Channel 5. It's on the old TV. Everything Everywhere All at Once was too freaking weird. I mean, it's weird for me, but I like weird shit.
Yeah.
I think like an old person would be like, what the fuck? What the fuck's going on? Is that Short Round?
I don't know, because I definitely disagree with you, Dave, on the count that I think people, once they're in a theater or a spot to watch this film, you know, maybe sans some distractions, I think once you get into it, I think you can't help but continue watch, minus those few people who walked out when I saw it. But I would recommend this to, you know, to anybody of age to see the film, because I think there's something to get out of this. There's such a universal theme in this film. There's so much to get out of it that I think applies to so many people's lives. And nobody's had an easy time, no matter what your status or whatever. Everybody's had a hard time in their life at some point. And I think this touches on a lot of those universal truths and struggles. And I don't know, if you're open to cinema and you just don't want to watch the same Matlock episodes you've been watching since, you know, whatever, 1975, Grandma, like, I think you can still get something out of this film. So.
I know the boomers are lame and we like to dunk on them all the time, but I think this isn't too far of a stretch of a movie for them.
I agree.
Yeah,
I remember The Curse of Dracula.
I always
give
boy.
This a watch. I remember The Frankensteins.
You remember The Wolf Man? Yeah, very good.
Wow, the Phantom of the Opera is here. I'd recommend it. I think this is an amazing movie.
I agree.
Yes.
For multiple different reasons, not just because of Emma Stone and her beautiful, beautifulness, but like, oh my God, I just love weird shit. And like, this feels like a hybrid of like gothic horror, avant-garde art house, and then like a heartfelt story of a woman coming to age, loss of innocence, growing up, liberation at the core of it.
Yeah.
I think that's why it resonates with so many people, because it's like we have this weird fantastical story, but at the very core of it, so many people can relate to it. Not just women, men too.
Yeah.
Like this is like a universal thing. It's like, oh, I wish I could be like Bella. Bella.
Bella.
I wish I could be with Bella. Oh, my God.
And like I agree too, and it's not just weird for weirdness sake. Like there is – you feel a point. I don't think you have to be – versed in film, the language of cinema, to understand like that the things that are the strange things that are going on are, you know, they all work within the world. They're not just to be like, hey, look at this weird ceiling in my house. that's pretty weird, huh? You know, like it all works together. And I think you can, that's a testament to Yorgos Lanthimos. You can feel that without it having to be telegraphed to you.
Yeah, I think to put it in a way, I think this is the most accessible weird movie that there's been in quite some time.
It's very approachable.
Yeah, I agree.
And like, it's not weird for weird's sake. Like everything has a purpose and a meaning behind it.
Yes.
Yeah.
And we're all creatives here, and we know the importance of having meaning behind every stylistic choice or design choice.
Totally.
Because if there is no meaning, then what the fuck is this? So it's weird for weird's sake.
We get it. You went to art school. Jesus.
Yeah. Guys, this has been a blast.
Yes.
I love talking movies with you too.
Always a good time.
Yeah.
Thanks for having us, man. For real.
We need to do this more than once a year. And I need to go on your show.
Yes.
Well,
yes.
We are we're gonna start production on season 5 here soon. And we do like to have at least one guest every odd numbered season. So,
oh my God,
got the homie coming in. We'll give you a slate of the things we're talking about, and then you can decide what you want to talk about.
Okay. Yeah. All right. Just send me a DM. Just slide into my DMs and let me know.
Don't mind if I do.
Please don't leave us on red again.
No. In my defense, I forgot. You're like, all right, when are we recording? And I missed it.
Oh, is that a thing? I was just kidding. I don't run the Instagram.
Dave does.
Yeah.
He's like, all right, when are we recording? And I was like, no. Okay, I have to tell them when to record. I'll get back to them. And then I look and I'm like, oh, fuck. I'm not ghosted, you guys. I swear. Yeah,
it's funny because I saw that. I was like, yeah, he's busy, whatever. And then, whatever, like a week later, Blake was like, so what time are we recording? And I went, I don't know.
I was like, whenever you guys are ready. You are the guest. I'll make it happen.
Cordial,
guys, this was a blast. Yes, yes. Where can people find more of you guys? You guys have like a podcast or something?
Oh, it's so funny you mentioned that. We totally do. Did you forget again, Blake?
Oh, gee, I don't know. I had these blackouts recently. I don't know.
Yes,
it blacks out every time you guys record.
Yeah, it's like talking to a wall 5 minutes after. Yes, we have a podcast. We are called First Prize Films, and you can find us anywhere that you get your podcasts, except for Stitcher, which is now a running joke because they stopped being a thing. And yes, we're also on all of the social medias, TikTok, Threads, Twitter, whatever the hell, and check us out on there. And Blake, we're also on YouTube, aren't we?
We you can see us on YouTube in full color. No, it's not in color.
No,
you can watch us on video. you can watch our podcast. We take two movies of the same genre and pit them against each other. Our last episode we did Romances from Hell. We talked about True Romance and Wild at Heart, David Lynch's Wild at Heart. And Dave was mad at me still about that one. But it's a good time. So you can listen to that on your podcast platforms. Or again, if you want to watch us and look at my stupid face and my terrible expressions, you can watch that and see the movie clips along with it on the YouTube, which is just look at First Price Films. It's on there. We're very popular there.
We're like the biggest podcast on YouTube.
Huge.
It's shot on 16 millimeter black and white Kodak film.
It's see, you get us, Armand.
Digitized. Just, yeah.
You know, we resonate.
It's art. It's art. I love that film grain. I was like, ooh, look at that. They're artists.
I see.
I love it. And you guys are on Twitch just shooting the shit, and I love it.
Yes, we also like to watch old movies that are in the public domain and have a drink or so and chat with people about these weird B movies that we like to find on the internet. So,
oh my god, I'm gonna join the chat for that.
Yes,
I'm gonna be in the chat. That's you're speaking my language, right,
dude?
Now.
It's my favorite thing to do in the world, short of this, of course. Present company excluded.
Wait.
Shut up, Dave. So check us out there.
Yes, please do. I'll go on there. I'll make you guys watch Low Blow or Alien Private Eye.
I love Alien Private Eye. Oh, my God.
Remlo.
Remlo is my favorite. He's got the best style, the coolest dances, and I just want his hat. I want his hat. I've been trying to find a good version of this so I can show it to Dave.
Dave is shook right now.
I don't know what that.
What the fuck?
You guys are saying a lot of words, and none of them are meaning a single thing.
These are words. I don't know what they mean together. Oh my god, we have to do that for real. That's amazing.
Oh yeah,
guys, we've been going for like 90 minutes.
We have to.
This is amazing. Well, we dissected this film, and oh my god, I can't wait to watch it again. To be honest,
yeah.
Thank you, guys.
Of course.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. Until the next one, buddy.
Until the next time. Stop that scroll and spend more time watching. Bye, everybody.
That's it for this time on The Syndicate. We hope you enjoyed yourself. Keep the conversation going by adding us on Instagram and Letterboxd, where you can catch Armand along other podcasters and listeners at Syndicate. And until next time, stop that scroll and spend more time watching. Goodbye.